You know, I haven't, I've already had nothing.
Good morning. I'm calling the Property Tax Division to order. And I want to thank everyone, members, staff, and audience members for coming on a Friday early in the morning to help us in our work. And I can say I've heard from a lot of people since we released the division report, and we appreciate the new information and insights that we're gathering. We know that our hearings oftentimes don't give people much chance to get into much detail, and the information you're providing is changing some of the things in the report as we go along. And so I just want people to know that in addition to those who testify today, we've been hearing from others, and we're doing our best to be responsive and understand the implications of the decisions before us. But the people who most help us, oftentimes public and members, understand the implications of property tax law and changes to it, our wonderful House research staff and our House fiscal staff helps us understand the fiscal implications. And so we're going to start today with them walking us through the bill article by article, and then we will take public testimony. And while we do have on the agenda listed a variety of people who've signed up in advance, we do have some legislators who'd like to provide input as they squeeze in opportunities between presenting bills and other committees and being in other committees. So just so you know, we may not 100% adhere to the order of speakers here, but we will generally follow that. But now that we do have a quorum, I think our first action should be approving the minutes of March 25th, 2019. Representative Dzikowski moves approval of the minutes of March 25th. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay? The minutes are adopted. Thank you very much. And with that, welcome Mr. Swanson, who will take us through the first article.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. We are going to walk through the division report article by article. In your packet, you should have a bill summary from House Research. It may be helpful to follow along with that as we go through each article. So I'm going to start with Article 1, which is the property tax article, beginning with Section 1. So Section 1 allows a city or town to fund its own historical society through its property tax levy. Current law only allows them to fund the county's historical society. Section 2 of the article provides that the Commissioner of Transportation will certify aid amounts for the Small Cities Assistance Program to the Commissioner of Revenue by June 1st. Section 3, along with Section 21 in this article, authorizes the county's veteran service officer to share certain data with the county assessor, and this is just related to the disabled veterans homestead market value exclusion. Section 4 of this article amends the Commissioner of Revenue's power to administer the state's property tax laws by clarifying that the commissioner can collect property tax data at the parcel level or higher. This is related to the PRISM reporting system changes that were put in place a couple of years ago. And there are a number of sections within Article 1 that make simple conforming and cross-reference changes related to this section. Sections 5 through 7 are three of those, but there will be more as we go throughout the first article. Section 8 of Article 1 just increases the amount of property that can be exempt from property taxes for agricultural historical societies. That increase takes the exemption up from 20 acres up to 40 acres. Section 9 provides a 10-year property tax exemption for a pharmacy in Minneapolis owned by an Indian tribe. Section 10 exempts from property taxes charitable farmland that is owned by a public hospital, a house of worship, or a cemetery, as long as the proceeds from the sale of the products raised on that charitable farmland are used to support the mission of a public hospital, house of worship, or a cemetery. Section 11 changes the threshold for filing a certificate of real estate value from $1,000 up to $3,000. And sections 12 through 16 again make conforming and cross-reference changes related to Section 4. Section Section 17, along with Section 36, will allow manufactured home park cooperative residents to include a portion of their ground lease payments as a part of their property taxes paid when applying for property tax refunds. Sections 18 and 19 make some changes to the agricultural homestead determinations. So Section 18 simply eliminates some language that gets reinstated in Section 19. But Section 19 also modifies the special ag homestead statute to allow certain types of property owned by trust to qualify for agricultural homestead. So this section changes the statute so that the rules requiring agricultural property to have the same ownership are satisfied if the properties are owned by some combination of the individual owner, the individual spouse or surviving spouse, or a trust or trusts, the grantor of which is the individual, the spouse, the surviving spouse, or the deceased spouse. Section 20 clarifies that when there are multiple owners of a homestead property, the ownership percentages are determined by the county land records. If this method of determining fractional ownership is not cannot be used, then the ownership percentages are simply determined to be equal shares. Section 21 was something that I covered back in Section 3. Again, it's just the allows the County Veterans Service Officer to share data with the County Assessor for the Disabled Veterans Homestead Market Value Exclusion. Section 22 establishes a property tax deferral program for an elderly living facility in Duluth. As long as the property continues to meet the requirements of this section, the facility is treated as if it were exempt from property taxes. But if the property is sold, transferred, or no longer meets these requirements, then the owner must pay property taxes that would have been due on the property for the last 5 years. Section 23 allows land to continue to qualify as agricultural, even if up to 3 acres of the land is used to serve environmental purposes. Section 24 changes the application deadline for the Disabled Veterans Homestead Market Value Exclusion from July 1 to December 15. Section 25 amends the homestead market value exclusion statute just to clarify that if there are multiple owners of a homestead, that the exclusion is prorated among those owners. Section 26 again makes conforming and cross-reference updates to the changes made by Section 4. And Section 27 amends the agricultural homestead market value credit statute to clarify that if there are multiple owners of an agricultural homestead, that this credit is prorated among the owners of that property, and that the proration happens on ownership shares, which are determined using the county land records that I outlined in Section 20. I'm now going to turn it over to Ms. Hagler, and she'll take you the rest of the way through Article 1.
Thank you, Ms. Hagler. Thank you, Mr. Swanson.
Madam Chair and members, so starting with Section 28 through 33 are also conforming changes to the Department of Revenue System PRISM update that's referenced in Section 4. So then I'll just move into Section 34, which requires the Commissioner to issue a deed of land sold at a tax forfeiture sale if the County Auditor has written confirmation from a closing agent that the purchase money for deed is held in escrow. Section 35 is in line with the changes made to the CRV in Section 11 and changes the maximum consideration for collecting the deed tax from $500 to $3,000. Section 36 relates back to Section 17 and allows a resident shareholder of manufactured home cooperatives to add 17% of their ground lease payments in consideration of their homestead refund. Section 37 deals with the senior deferral program and moves the application date from July 1 back to November 1. Sections 38 and 39 also relate back to the PRISM updates from Section 4. Section 40 authorizes a state agency or government unit to initiate expiration of the Ag Preserve Program. Section 41 provides that an Ag Preserve expires immediately when the public entity purchases the property or acquires an easement for purposes of a trail or park. and this expiration would only apply to the portion that is used for the trailer park. Section 42 also just relates back to the Section 41 in a conforming change. And Section 43 extends the levy authority for the Northwest Minnesota Multi-County Housing and Redevelopment Authority by another 5 years. Sections 44 through 48 have to do with the Cloquet Fire and Ambulance Special Taxing District. Section 44 and 45 are changing the name of the district so that it is Cloquet Area Fire and Ambulance Special Taxing District as the name. Sections 46 and 47 allow bonding authority for this district, and this is a kind of a clarification of a 2014 special law that was intended to provide this authority, but in fact did not, so now these two sections are providing that authority. Section 49 provides that a debt levy in the municipality that wishes to withdraw from the district and remains in effect until all the obligations are satisfied. And Section 49 reallocates between the city and the county the amounts appropriated from the grant and allows a longer period in which the appropriation can be spent. Section 50 amends an effective date to the SFIA provision that was enacted in 2017. It allows for a bike trail through the land enrolled in the SFIA program without the land being forced out of the program. And it just clarifies that it just conforms with the 2017 to incorporate the specific project it was meant to. Section 51 is a report from the Commissioner of Revenue and requires them to issue a report that analyzes certain aspects of the state assessed property system. And the report is required to be due to the chairs of the House and Senate in charge of property taxes by January 15th. And the summary provides what is included in the report. Section 42 is another requirement for the Commissioner of Revenue to issue a report to the legislature that analyzes certain aspects of 4D housing programs, and they would do that in conjunction with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. Section 53 allows a veteran who received a disability rating of 70% or more in 2016 or 2017 to apply for homestead refund, and this refund would be equal to what they would have gotten in 2017 or 2018 had they been given that disability rating. And Section 54 is the repealer that relates back to Section 4, which is the PRISM update, and is just repealing the statute that describes the abstract of tax list. So that concludes Article 1.
Thank you very much. Article 2 is the aids and credits article, and we're going to now have that reviewed. Thank you very much. It's been a popular article.
Okay, so as Chair Loeffler said, this article is primarily aids and credits, and you will see a brief summary of all that's included right there at the top. But I will start with Section 1, which is the provision that extends the sunset paid by the Commissioner of Revenue to local governments for their contribution to the UPERO program. And it would expire in either June 2048 or the year after the plan becomes fully funded. And Section 2 increases the school bonding ag credit from 40% to 70% on the property attributed to the school district bond debt levies. The credit is available to all property classified as agricultural, excluding the house, garage, and surrounding 1 acre.
Madam Chair and members, Sean Williams from House Research.
Welcome, Mr. Williams.
So Section 3 deals with the homestead credit refund. makes two main changes to the homestead credit refund. First, it increases the maximum refund amounts by about by $200 for most existing recipients of the credit. A few of the income ranges get an increase of $175. The section also expands the range of incomes that are eligible for the credit. So under current law, the highest household income that you can have and still claim the credit is $115,439. And the bill would increase that such that people with incomes up to So the highest income under this would be $155,439. Section 4 is the renter's credit. So it also makes two sort of main changes to the renter's credit. First, it reduces the co-payments, so the percent paid by claimant in statute for the renter's credit program, by either 2.5 or 5 percentage points, sort of depending on the income range. The bill also expands the availability of the credit. So under current law, the credit is limited to individuals or claimants with household income of $62,560 or less, and the bill would increase that income range up to $74,999. Sections 5 and 6 are language that was originally in House File 2286 by Representative Loeffler. They sort of relate to certificates of rent paid. I would say that there's sort of four main or three main changes in those sections. First, it requires the Department of Revenue to develop sort of an automated electronic system for generating certificates of rent paid. Second, effective for rents paid in 2021, it requires landlords and managing agents to use the automated system created. And finally, it also requires, effective that year, that landlords provide additional rental market information to the Department of Revenue. Main change from the Delete Everything Amendment that was adopted in committee is that the new language clarifies that owners and managing agents can provide equivalent data to the Commissioner of Revenue in a form and manner approved by the Commissioner. And then Section 6 requires an annual report on rents paid in Minnesota, and that language is unchanged from the amendment that was adopted in committee. So beginning in 2022, the Department of Revenue would have to produce an annual report on rental market trends in the state. And that concludes Sections 5 and 6.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Swanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Section 7 and 8 deal with the production tax distributions to the Taconite Municipal Aid account. Section 7 guarantees the distribution to this account at 100% of the 1983 distribution and eliminates the decrease in the distribution when production falls below 42 million taxable tons. The increase in this guarantee would reduce the amounts distributed to the Taconite Environmental Protection Fund and the Douglas J. Johnson Economic Protection Trust Fund. Section 8 indexes to inflation the amount distributed to the Taconite Municipal Aid account. Sections 9 and 10 deal with the border cities enterprise zones. So Section 9 provides an annual allocation of $1 million to cities with border cities enterprise zones, and these funds can be used for tax reductions currently allowed within the zones in those cities. Section 10 is just technical cleanup language that clarifies the types of property that can qualify for tax reductions within the border cities enterprise zones. Section 11 sets the sparsity adjustment in the LGA formula for both large and small cities at the current $200 amount for small cities. And Section 12 deletes language related to obsolete LGA adjustments for individual cities and provides additional LGA payments for a few cities. Those amounts and cities are outlined in the summary. Section 13 increases the LGA appropriation by about $30.6 million for aids payable in 2020 and thereafter. Section 14 increases the county program aid appropriation by about $30.6 million as well. And this increase is split evenly between the need aid portion of the formula and the tax base equalization aid portion of the formula. Section 14 also increases the aid distribution to Mahnomen County in 2020 by $750,000. Of this amount, $250,000 must be used by the county for the Mahnomen Health Center, and $250,000 must be paid from the county to the White Earth Band of Ojibwe to reimburse the band for costs of delivering child welfare services. Section 15 makes a one-time appropriation from the general fund in fiscal year 19 to reimburse the city of Austin for 2016 fire aid and supplemental police and fire retirement aid it did not receive due to a dispute over the 2015 aid payments. Section 16 reappropriates the unused fire remediation grants to the city of Melrose. And Section 17 appropriates $5,000 from the general fund to the city of Mazeppa and to Wabasha County to pay for property tax abatements and other costs associated with a fire in the city in 2018. And that concludes Article 2.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. And the next article is our local option sales tax article, which has a variety of changes in it. We've been getting a lot of feedback. There will be changes made to some of this language related to certain projects. But, you know, I think cities were looking increasingly to this. We had more local bills than we've ever had before, the property tax division, and they varied in their specificity and even in terms of what they presented to the voters. And it signals a response over the last years at our inability to keep local government aid increasing like we have in this bill. And cities looking for alternative revenue sources. It's also been tied to transportation funding in some communities, which is something we hadn't seen in the past, and of course that's a big issue this year. And it's one that we're continuing to look at because these have traditionally been focused on regional projects, and some of them the cities have been getting back to us with clearer information about their projects and their impact. As we go ahead. We've also been hearing, though, from the business community that these do make their life much more difficult in terms of calculating the sales tax. It's true, especially now that people do so much online purchasing and you have to pay the sales tax based on where it's delivered to. And so this increases the complexity for every merchant, including those in other parts of Minnesota, selling to other Minnesotans. So we're looking at each of these individually again. We've gotten some great feedback from people, and we'll continue to welcome that as we make some adjustments moving forward. I just thought since this had gotten a lot of discussion in recent days that we should just note that this is an area that we're continuing to take in information and make some adjustments. And with that, welcome to the committee, Ms. Dalton, to walk us through it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Pat Dalton with House Research. I'm going to be focusing on the changes in the bills that are included in here from how they were presented to committee, because I think that's the thing that most people are interested in. Sections 1 through 4 are Chair Loeffler's bill that is modifying the scope of the local sales tax general law. The only difference in this from the way it was presented in committee is that it has a, in section 4, there was a paragraph F added that basically said a city that receives local authority this year that is more limited than the authorizing referendum may return and seek to have the tax extended without an additional referendum, provided that they submit a detailed resolution under subdivision 3, which is Section 3 of this bill, that does not conflict with the language of their original 2018 resolution. So it's a way for them to come back and make a more detailed case. Section 5 is the Duluth local sales tax. It's reduced from, originally they wanted it for 30 years, it's reduced to 5 years, or when $40 million is raised, whichever is earlier. And it changes the use from just general local roads to limiting it to arterial and collector roads. Section 6 is the removal of the cap on the lodging tax in Minneapolis, and this is as the bill was introduced. Section 7 is the lodging tax for St. Paul, and again, there's no change. Section 8 is the two harbors. Is Section 8 and Section 23 go together. They relate to the Lake County lodging tax, and this is the two harbors version where we are limiting the Two Harbors lodging tax to 5% to allow that 4% Lake County tax. It's no change from the bill as discussed in committee. Sections 9 through 12 were House File 1436, an increase in the Two Harbors lodging tax. Generally, the change has been that there originally we're looking for $30 million or 25 years of authority for a number of projects related to streets and water and sewer projects. The projects have not been changed, but the limit on the tax has been decreased to 5 years or when $6 million is raised. Section 13 is the Cloquet local sales tax, which is just allowing them to shift some money between existing projects that are authorized, and that has not changed. Section 14 is the City of Avon local sales tax. They were originally seeking $1.5 million of revenue raising authority or until 2045. This has been changed to $300,000 or 5 years. The projects have not been changed. The City of Blue Earth is Section 15. Again, they were looking for $5 million or 25 years of authority. They've been given authority for to raise $1 million or until the tax has been imposed for 5 years. Again, there was no change in their list of projects, which included sewer, street reconstruction, and recreational amenities. Section 16 is the local sales tax for the City of Cambridge. They came in with two projects. One was the library and one was the street improvements. The language here allows them to impose the local sales tax for the lodging but not the street improvements, and so the expiration date is adjusted downward for the elimination of the street improvement projects. Section 17 is the local sales tax for the City of Detroit Lakes, which was only for one project, and that was not changed. Section 18 is the local sales tax for the City of Elk River. They had a list of a number of projects that they wanted to be able to raise $35 million for. They're only being allowed to raise $27 million, and the project list was reduced to keep the major park multi-use building and lake dredging. So they went from $35 million and a long list to two projects for $27 million. Section 19 is the City of Excelsior local sales tax. There was no change made to what they could fund. However, their voter approval was originally in 2014, so if they are going to impose this, they now have to go back to the voters for a new voter approval. Section 20 is the City of Glenwood local sales tax. They again came in for a number of street projects, a city hall and park and recreational facility. They were allowed just the projects related to the park and recreational facility and regional trails. Their allowed revenue raising was decreased from $2.8 million to $1 million, and the expiration date is reduced from 20 years to 8 years. For the City of International Falls, they were looking for funding for transportation and other public infrastructure projects. They were looking for $30 million or 30 years. They were given $5 million or 5 years. Section 22 is the La Crescent local lodging tax extra authority, which was Representative David's bill. This went in without any changes. Section 23 is the remaining part of the Lake County local lodging tax bill. The changes made to this section is that there had been a list that one-fourth of the revenue raised by the 4% tax had to go to promoting community events and festivals in specific cities. The list of cities were removed, and it's just community events and festivals. And the other addition is, although any city who currently has a lodging tax in the county may continue to keep it, no new city or town lodging taxes can be imposed in Lake County while the county tax is in effect. Section 24, City of North Mankato local food and beverage tax. This went in as discussed in committee. Section 25, the City of Perham local sales tax. The only change was this was originally set to cover both the community, the capital and administrative costs of the reconstruction project of the community center there. The only thing that was removed was the administrative costs. The amount that can be raised remains the same. Section 26 is the local lodging tax for the City of Plymouth. They were looking for a 3% tax to fund public recreational facilities with no expiration date. The bill puts a 5-year expiration date on this authority and requires 1/3 of the money has to be used for marketing and promotion of the local convention, a local convention or tourism bureau. Section 27, the local sales tax for the City of Sauk Center. Originally, they were looking to fund both Trunk Highway 71 and projects in the city's capital improvement plan, which were unspecified. They were looking for $10 million or till expiration date of 2045. This is reduced to $2 million or 5 years. The local sales tax for Scanlon is in Section 28. They were originally looking for $400,000 or 10 years to fund street improvement and utility infrastructure projects. This is reduced to $200,000 or 5 years. The City of Virginia is Section 29. They were looking for $30 million for a very specific memorial recreation complex and convention center. There was no change made to that bill. Section 30, City of Wilmer, local sales and use tax, and $20 excise tax. They were originally looking for $30 million or 13 years, and this was reduced to $7 million for 3 years. They had a number of projects listed. This was limited to their community center and the projects in two regional parks. And Section 31, City of Worthington, their local sales tax, they were originally looking for $25 million over 13 years to fund a number of park and recreational facility lake quality improvements and a street plaza improvement. The street plaza was removed, and the amount that they were authorized to raise was reduced to $10 million or what they could raise in 10 years. And with that, that is the end of Article 3.
Thank you very much, Ms. Dalton. And on to Article 4, Tax Increment Financing.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Alex Hegler, House Research. So with Article 4, as with Article 3, some of these provisions were modified from their original, from what they were introduced as. Section 1 provides authority for the City of Bloomington and extends the 5-year rule to 20 years, and this was modified from its original bill, which asked for just a removal of the 5-year rule. Sections 2 and 3 provide authority to the City of Edina. Section 2 allows it to create TIF districts until 2021, and Section 3 allows increment generated from another district to be used in this housing district, and this went in as introduced. Section 4 provides authority to the City of Champlin that extends the 5-year rule to 10 years and extends the district's duration an additional 5 years, and also exempts the requirement that it start using increment in the 6th year to pay off to decertify. I believe this was modified. Section 5 is for the city of Minneapolis for the Upper Harbor Terminal. It establishes redevelopment districts that don't have to meet the statutorily required blight findings for the redevelopment district, as this district had some special circumstances and unique things in it. And then it also increment from the established district is not required to be spent on correction of the blight conditions. It extends the 5-year rule to 10 years and exempts it from the percentage pooling requirements. And that went in as introduced. Section 6 relates to the Roseville Hazardous Substance Subdistrict, and it allows them to spend increments that have been already collected past the 5 years after certification, and this also went in as introduced. Section 7 provides authority for the city of Duluth to create districts within a project area in downtown. And this district is also able to establish redevelopment districts without the statutorily required blight findings and the requirement that the increment be spent on blight correction. This went in with some modifications. And lastly is Burnsville, Section 8. This allows the city to create also redevelopment districts that don't have to meet the statutorily required blight findings, and allows them to spend increment on or be exempt from the requirement that increment be spent on the correction of blight conditions. And this is limited to the area that covers the Burnsville Center Mall and adjacent rights of way. And that is Article 4, and I'll turn it over to Mr. Klayman for
Thank you so much, Ms. Hagler, and welcome, Mr. Klayman. Article 5.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Chris Klayman with House Research, and I'll go through Article 5. This is the public finance article. Section 1 and Section 8, this is the state fair bonding bill. Section 1 just increases the total amount of bonds that can be issued by the State Agricultural Society. Section 8 repeals the expiration of the Agricultural Society's bonding authority. The rest of the sections are from the public finance bill that were heard in this committee last week. There were a few provisions that were in the public finance bill that was heard that are not in Article 5. Of the division report, there were two provisions relating to a 7-day notice requirement that are not in Article 5. In addition, there was a provision related to a heating and cooling district or privately owned heating and cooling districts that's not in the bill, and then there was some bonding authority language for counties imposing the transportation sales tax that is also not in Article 5. Otherwise, all of the other provisions here were in the public finance bill. Section 2 was the drainage lien interest provision that increases the maximum interest rate that can be charged on drainage lien principal to 6%. Right now it's a floating rate. Section 3 is the bond authorization provision for certain school district projects that just eliminates the requirement that prior to the solicitation of project bids, a school district has to provide public notice. Section 4 is related to the disbanding of CTIB. This is language that clarifies that because CTIB has been disbanded, technically all 87 counties in the metropolitan transportation area are now outside of that area and may now impose a transportation sales tax. Section 5 is a provision related to just updating a reference to the United States Bankruptcy Code. And this is would have to do with municipal bankruptcies. Section 6 is narrowing the prohibition that was enacted in 2017 that prohibited the Met Council for issuing debt to finance light rail improvements. That particular provision, when it was enacted, applied not just to the obligations that were issued in the 2017 law, but to other obligations for which there was already statutory authority. And so that is the so Section 6 clarifies that issue. Section 7 modifies the definition of a municipality for purposes of issuing capital improvement bonds.
so that any town, regardless of population, can issue those bonds, and then those towns would then be able to issue capital improvement bonds without a referendum. Section 8, I already went over. That's just the second part of the state fair bonding bill. And, Madam Chair, that concludes Article 5.
Thank you, Mr. Clayman. And now to go over the fiscal analysis, we have Catherine Schill.
Good morning, Chair Loeffler and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Catherine Schill. I'm with House Fiscal Analysis. And before you today, you have the division report, House File 2348, and the fiscal impacts are summarized on a five-page spreadsheet. I will draw your attention to the small print at the top of this spreadsheet that identifies that positive numbers are program expenditures or revenue losses, and negative numbers are cost savings or revenue gains. This presentation is similar to other program expenditures by other committees. The general general fund summary is provided on lines 1, 2, and 3. Property tax base for AIDS credits and refunds base funding from the February 2019 forecast. I will read the biennial numbers, $3.738 billion dollars for fiscal 22-23, $3.944. Those are the base numbers. And what you have before you in the spreadsheet is the total changes to the general fund reflected on line 2. For aids and credits and refunds, the changes total $147,369,000, and for fiscal 22-23, $327,307,000. So total spending with those changes plus the base budget is $885,492,000 in fiscal 2021. And $4,271,401,000 in fiscal 22-23. Lines 5 through 29 provide the changes in the property tax refund. Most of this is garnered in three bills on lines 8, 10, and 12. Total property tax refund changes for fiscal 2021 are $44.3 million, and for fiscal 22-23, $100.64 million. Property tax changes on lines 30 through, going on to page 2, 30 through 60, are basically the impacts from House File 567, which is the chair's carry over non-controversial low-cost provisions from the 2008 omnibus tax bill. And on line 45, House File 632, the chair's non-controversial no-cost provisions from the 2018 tax bill. Those two provisions, the property tax change subtotal is $644,000 for fiscal 19. That's mostly from the reallocation of the Melrose Fire Remediation Project. And then for 2021, total property tax subtotal is a negative $530,000. And for 22-23, a positive $55,000. Changes to aids and credits can be found on between line 61 and 98. Major changes you will see on line 63 with Representative Mark Quartz, House File 1163, which is the LGA appropriation to cities. That is the $30.6 million that Mr. Swenson commented in his presentation, but you can see that there are also property tax refunds interactions and income tax refund interactions. So on the spreadsheet, those totals, we have some savings, so they're not quite so costly. For that, you can see on line 67. Moving further down the spreadsheet, also from House File 1163, were the CPA appropriations, those county program aid appropriations. They follow the same pattern as the LGA appropriations. Once again, the appropriation in fiscal 21 for county program aid was $30.6 million, but there are also some cost savings with the interactions, and so that price tag is just below $30 million. Moving down the page, line 86, this is the school building bond agricultural credit with Representative Marquardt's bill. The price on that is approximately $30 million in fiscal 21, and it grows somewhat in the tails. Another item that you will see on the spreadsheet, line 92, is the public employees retirement aid program. This sunset is extended. The price tag is with the interactions included is found on line 96. It's $13.2 million in fiscal 21 and about the same for each year in the tails. Local aid subtotal is $129,000 in fiscal 19, $102.8 million in fiscal 2021, and $226,612,000 in 22-23. All those items add up on line 100, and that is the same as you saw on line number 2 brought forward in the spreadsheet summary. Moving on to page 3, you have non-general fund changes. This is from Representative Leslie Gard's bill, House File 324. So you have the impact with the Taconite Municipal Aid Account, Douglas Johnson Economic Protection Fund, and the Taconite Environmental Protection Fund. Pages 4 and 5 are tracking changes, but basically all of these items have no state fund impact. So you'll see on lines 116 through 142, all of the local option sales tax, lodging, food and beverage tax changes. There is no cost to any state fund. Line 143, moving on to page 5 through 151, are all of the changes associated with tax increment financing. And the last items are the public finance bills. I will notice on line 160, labeled as other, there are Department of Revenue administrative costs which have not yet been totally scored, and so right now this is a to-be-determined item. Usually this is calculated once we have an omnibus tax bill. So at this point, it's kind of like too early prime time of a calculation. So it's right now scored as zero, but will change. That concludes the spreadsheet, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair, or Ms. Jill. Sorry, I'm just, I'm looking at my bills going, oh, is this the point at which I move the delete everything amendment? Thank you very much, before we have the public hearing. So thank you very much to our staff for assembling all of this. They are so dedicated and are always willing to look at alternatives and run the computers and get us the numbers. And with the assistance of the Department of Revenue and other state agencies as we do this, we really appreciate this. And thank you very much. Now, before we go to the public testimony, I think we're going to get the bill into its final form. And we have before you House File 2348 as the division report. And I would like to move the DE amendment. It's A190302. The staff has just described for us what the contents of that are. So any discussion? Otherwise, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Thank you very much. Now we have the bill officially before us, and it is the motion prevailed, and our motion was adopted, and we do now have the proposed division report before us. And we're going to open this up to public testimony, and given that we, unfortunately, in this time of deadlines, are restricted to using the room till 10, we're going to have to ask people to limit their comments to 2 minutes or less. And we're going to begin with Commissioner Bowerly. Okay, welcome, Commissioner. We appreciate your feedback.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I will be brief, but I appreciate the opportunity to share some comments about the division report. I might first start, Madam Chair, by echoing your compliments to the staff at the legislature, the House staff. We enjoy working so much with them. We appreciate the professionalism and the collegiality that we have with the nonpartisan staff at the Department of Revenue, and we all know that without them, the rest of us would not be able to complete the work that we do on behalf of Minnesotans here in this room. So I want to start by noting, Madam Chair, that Governor Walz's budget is based on three priorities: education, health care, and community prosperity. And these priorities are reflected in the tax and budget proposals he put forward, and many of those priorities are shared in this division report that your committee has put forward today, particularly focusing on community prosperity. Making investments in local governments and providing significant property tax relief will strengthen our communities across the state of Minnesota. I want to thank you for prioritizing local governments in this bill with an additional $30 million for LGA and $30 million for CPA. These are the same amounts proposed in the governor's budget, and these historic investments will help local governments pay for the vital services that they provide to citizens across the state of Minnesota. I also want to commend the chair for including Chair Marquardt's proposal to expand the Ag School Bond Credit. As you know, this is a critical time for Minnesota farmers, and the most recent report from the University of Minnesota Extension and Minnesota State found that farm income is 8% lower this year than last year, and it's at the lowest that it's been in 23 years. Governor Walz, too, understands the challenges facing Minnesota's farmers and included conformity on Section 179 expensing and also a buffer tax credit in his tax bill to reduce farmers' property tax bills. We share the commitment to providing farmers with property tax relief, whether that comes from the buffer credit or something like the school bond credit. We look forward to working with you to make sure farmers receive property tax relief in a final bill. We also want to commend the property tax refund expansion, providing over $40 million in just the first year to Minnesota homeowners and renters so that they can more afford their property taxes, including making sure that families in our lower income and our working families can really afford to find a good place to live and raise their families. We support the division report's provision to move the application date for the senior citizens property tax deferral program to November 1st. This is also in the governor's proposal, and we would also like to continue talking about addressing the occupancy requirements and reducing that from 15 to 5 years. These policy changes will help more seniors stay in their home. We also appreciate you including some of the department's policy and technical provisions in your report. These include the minimum deed tax and certificate of real estate value thresholds and parcel level data collection that will help all of us make better policy choices with good data. While these are small provisions, they will help many taxpayers. The department also understands the importance of addressing the fractional homestead issue, and we look forward to continuing to work with the committee to ensure that the provision you've included in the bill is administrable and treats taxpayers equitably. This report represents about $300 million per biennium in local government aid and direct property tax relief for Minnesotans who are working across the state of Minnesota to help ensure that they can support their families' budgets. In the coming weeks, we look forward to working with the Tax Committee to build upon this strong foundation to ensure a fair and equitable tax bill for all Minnesotans. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you for the generosity of your department in helping us put this together. Next, we have Representative Baker, and Mary Swatsky is with him, representing the city of Willmar. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I want to, first of all, thank the committee for including the Willmar local option sales tax project that we worked really, really hard with back in Willmar. I think that before it even came to the state, I wanted to make sure that as I was consulting with our Invest in Willmar team back home on a variety of very specific regional projects, I told them, we can't take anything for granted down here. We have to make sure that we have everything lined up, very specifically identified, to show the regional significance. I think they really did that. And to be included is great, and we're happy about that, into the division bill. But to see a 76% reduction of our work that the voters overwhelmingly supported, it causes me great concern. And so we are here again today, and I'll be finished when I'm done, and then Ms. Watsky will take over to show some of the details. But I just wanted to make sure that the rules that we worked within were the rules, I think, that everybody thought was going to be right when we came to the legislature this year. Seeing some of the changes coming down the road, I think, are good and positive. I will support those. But our community was working under the right set of rules for these projects, and we're very careful about this. We worked hard. They were door knocking. They were doing everything they should have done. But our projects and methodology was really important on this. And so I just hope that we take this carefully. We can't take that kind of a reduction and really do the project quality that we need to do. I'm just saying that we can't be stuck in the middle. We had an election based on the rules in front of us, and we hope that we can help reverse some of the decisions that have been made, and we urge you to reconsider the Wilmer project. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll hand over to Ms. Swatsky.
Welcome, Ms. Swatsky.
Good morning. Hello, Madam Chair, I'm Mary Swatsky and members of the committee. Representative Baker and I are here today to speak to House File 2348 with special notice to Wilmer's local option sales tax, which will support our projects with significant regional impact. Wilmer is a regional center located 100 miles west of the Twin Cities. It is a community rich with diverse cultures, blessed with higher education in Ridgewater College, schools of choice with public and private schools, as well as the Dream Academy, Technical Academy. We have a population of 20,000 and a workforce that doubles our population Monday through Friday each week. Our hospitals and medical centers serve as a regional center, as well as other health care entities and services of care from birth to later stages of life. MinWest Technology Campus, which was formerly State Hospital Regional Treatment Center, triggers a multitude of levels of employment for our rich agriculture surroundings. Listening to the citizens of Wilmer, a grassroots campaign was ignited from stakeholders looking to enhance the Wilmer area to attract and retain folks to rural Minnesota. Employment opportunities coupled with amenities strengthened our schools, tourism, and recreational choices. With the projects presented, our community is positioning for future generations that will enjoy a healthy lifestyle post-career at a place where people have called home. In review of the six projects passed by the voters with 61%, Robbins Island Regional Park is home to year-round outdoor activities, including but not limited to 3,500 plus outdoor concert goers, a spectacular display of Christmas lights, a destination playground for all abilities, and Swanson Field Regional Park have both been approved by the DNR as regional parks. The community center is presently used and enjoyed by over 50% of its users coming from outside the city of Wilmer. It too is a significant regional draw with programming for all ages and interests. The stormwater improvement project brings responsibility of sending clean water downstream. Runoff from the city of Wilmer directly flows to the Minnesota River, Mississippi River, and the Gulf of Mexico, as well as downstream lakes. Wilmer is where the lakes begin. The recreational fields, recreation and events center are staples of regional centers today. They provide year-round recreation activities that will attract and support economic growth and vitality for the entire regional area. Today, the dry floor events, in addition to the Civic Center programming, do not allow for continuation expansion for the demands placed on the existing space. So in conclusion, Wilmer has a strong history of being a community that has used local option sales tax. Wilmer is also the first city in Minnesota to sunset a local option sales tax and repeated in early onset again on another local option sales tax. The Invest in Wilmer Committee listened to the citizens of Wilmer and followed the local option sales tax requirements, which brings us to you today. please reconsider the economic impact and progress for this regional center. With the full $30 million approved, with 61% in favor of the local option sales tax. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And as I stated earlier, we're working on a variety of these where we've gotten a lot more detail than was originally shared in our review. Thank you very much. And we have Representative Zerwas. We're going to, as I said earlier, we're going to try and accommodate legislators who are juggling between committees today as they meet on this busy Friday. Welcome, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And thank you for fitting us in so I can hop back down to HHS Finance this morning. With me today is the City Administrator of the City of Elk River, and he's going to carry the bulk of the testimony. But before he begins, I just want to thank the committee for the opportunity to present our initial bill and then come back and provide comments on the chair's bill as she's released it. The concern that we have is that the City of Elk River feels that we followed the process laid out before us and the process that is in current state statute, which is to get the local votes in step one and come to the legislature in step two. As a part of that process, the city engaged in multiple years of community engagement, stakeholder meetings, putting together a plan that was cohesive enough and significant enough to bring the right stakeholders together. Within our ballot initiative, the City of Elk River, as was commended by this committee, listed out very specifically each project that would be a part of the plan moving forward if the local option sales tax was approved. That vote was held in November with nearly 65% of residents voting for that local option sales tax. And just to get a gauge where the community fell in line on this, I think it's important to take stock that there were two members of the City Council that approved moving this project forward and putting the measure on the ballot that were up for re-election. The mayor and one of the city councilwomen, both of those individuals were unchallenged in their re-elections. So this wasn't a contentious issue of moving forward with the ballot initiative or putting it on the ballot to move forward with this project list. And so this is the project list that our city developed along with key stakeholders. It's the project list that we presented in an itemized fashion in the ballot initiative, and it's the project list that was approved by nearly 65% voters by the City of Elk River. I know there's been questions about funding priorities for cities, and if you use a local option sales tax for projects, what do you use to fund other infrastructure and improvements? The city has a robust and well-financed capital investment, capital improvement plan. It's been following that. For roads and bridges, the city several years ago went to a franchise fee on their utility bill, and they used that method to fund their infrastructure within the city. And so this was really looked at as something that's above and beyond and had regional significance. And so that's why we moved it forward in this fashion. One of the concerns, some of the projects that were struck in the chair's bill were trail connections to regional trails. And so portions of the projects that certainly made the destinations regionally significant. And so with that, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to my testifier today, the City Administrator from the City of Elk River.
Welcome to committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Cal Portner. I'm the City Administrator for the City of Elk River.
Please continue.
So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the time to be here again today. When we were here a few weeks back, we were very proud to have the feedback from Representative Stokowski regarding the transparency we used in our process. And that's because we worked very hard over a period of four-plus years to develop this program to ensure that all the community needs were met. We expected our community to hold us accountable for what we were asking for, what we were looking for, and to follow through with that. And we're even more proud to see that language end up in the bill now for future projects such as this that will require the same transparency. So we're very happy with that. With it, the changes that were made to our bill are quite concerning for us, as Representative Zerwas has stated. As we developed our municipal facilities and improved our municipal facilities, we planfully thought about our future and where we're going to be matching with our comprehensive planning. Unfortunately, for our recreation facilities and amenities, we didn't work along that same lines until 4 or 5 years ago. And that was because as our community developed, most of our recreation facilities and parks were developed by volunteers. Donations generously, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears went into work for those. But they were meeting the immediate need for what the athletic associations needed or what different users groups such as the Lions were looking for. And with that, they created a number of amenities that people have come to love and expect to utilize for the long term. Unfortunately, because of the immediacy of their implementation, we were kind of landlocked for development, for the growth of our community. We weren't quite reflective for changes that have occurred. And for example, there's been a lot of new sports that have added, such as lacrosse. Soccer has grown. The addition of girls, the growth of girls in community sports has increased. And with that, changes demands for what we'd have at our parks, such as modern restrooms. You know, back in the day, the little boys don't mind going to a tree. Sometimes it's a point of pride, but it doesn't quite work the same for the mothers and the girls that are playing softball and soccer and lacrosse. And we heard that message from our constituents. It was very, very loud and clear. And so that's a part of the process that we use to work through this with numerous community meetings, master planning, surveys, one-on-one meetings with groups to put together a project that would maintain the assets that we have but also maintain the future of the assets. The city of Elk River as a regional center is bounded by cities that don't have recreation programs. So part of the challenges that we've had is when we reach out to folks to get support for these types of things, in most of our athletics associations, as many as 25% of the members come from the surrounding townships, which have grown fast over the last few years, and from the local cities or the neighboring cities who have also experienced tremendous growth in Otsego, Ramsey, and now then. So those folks are coming to our facilities to utilize that, and they don't have any means to participate in the funding of those items. And they've asked us in our community outreach that they told us that they were willing to help out, do their best, and they didn't have a problem paying a sales tax for the dinners they eat out and the places they go, the things they shop for, because they knew it was going to go back into their children, back into their families, back into their future. And so we're very confident going to the voters with this very specific project that outlined things that met the needs of what our community told us. And we were rewarded with that, with a 65% approval. We weren't building just a hockey rink for 500 people. We were building and preparing for our future. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. And we appreciate the feedback. We have Representative Eklund. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I want to thank you for hearing the initial bill in the first place, and thank you for including it in the final product. We appreciate it. We do have some concerns. With me today, I have City Councilor Harley Drogo from the City of International Falls. When International Falls did the referendum on the local option sales tax, they worked very hard. They achieved 63%, I believe, to pass this referendum. Most of us would like to see that number, I think, at one point in time in our lives. But 63% shows that the community worked really hard. Now we're concerned on the five-year limitation, because we don't know that the initial idea for the city was to sell bonds, and they don't know if with a five-year limitation on this that whether they can generate enough revenue to cover the debt service. So that's our main concern. And I'm certainly willing to work with I understand after our conversation yesterday, Madam Chair, some of the goals that you're trying to make, and I'm certainly willing to try to work towards that in the future. But as the previous testifier said, as we went by what we thought the program was laid out to be, and the city followed through, and so that's what we're asking to reconsider, and I'll leave the rest of the testimony up to Councillor Drova.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Harley Droba, City Councilor for International Falls.
Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair and committee members, I thank the committee for including International Falls local sales tax in H.R. 2348. Although I hold the title of council member, I speak today as a member of our community, the 62.78% of voters that voted yes for the infrastructure projects in our last election. I pleaded with my co-workers to cover my shift today so I could drive the 5 hours down here to speak to you because it's that important to our community. We really need the $30 million or 30-year 1% tax for the future of our community. Let me set the stage of why our infrastructure is in the shape it's in. As most of you know, we are on the top of the nation, both geographically and in bitter cold. We are a border town that was founded by a paper mill, and for almost a century, we grew in population. The city grew out from the paper mill, laying clay sewer tiles or sewer pipes in almost 80% of the footprint our city has today. Highway 53 and 1171 was then, as it is now, a timber superhighway, bringing in hundreds of thousands of truckloads of timber. Today we are the gateway for entry to Canada, a tourist destination for Voyageurs National Park, and a regional international hub for business, as we are the closest city of the same size in a 100-mile drive. So what does this really mean? Our weather, although it brings us international fame, is extremely hard on our roads, water lines, and infrastructure in general. A vast majority of our growth came when America was still laying clay pipe. Those trucks that have been delivering timber haven't stopped in 100 years, but our population growth has. We have been a shrinking community with the population of International Falls, roughly 6,000, and another 2,000 people live within a 5-mile radius of city limits. The council understood the complexity of where we were with our infrastructure needs, and we hired Wyndon Smith and Nolte to identify our needs and assess our streets, water, and sewer. The most interesting part of their study was the street assessments. If we were to start our streets in the next 5 years, the cost would be about $7 million for just the streets alone. If the roads are left to deteriorate past the 5 years, the cost goes up almost to double. Our sewer and water, which is in the same condition, needs to be addressed, preferably as we reconstruct the roads above. The total for these projects would be $17,509,195 over the next 15 years. These are the numbers that were provided in Representative Eklund's House File 144 that was presented on February 25th, 2019. As Representative Eklund pointed out, we are worried that we won't be able to bond to do the projects if we if it's only 5 years and $5 million. Article 3, Section 21 of the file before you, 2348, allows International Falls to implement a 1% tax for 5 years. I say that just based off of our research from the Minnesota Department of Revenue, we'll never get to the $5 million mark. We expect to collect roughly $850,000 a year. We plan specific projects for the first 15 years so that we could be financially responsible to both the citizens of International Falls and the patrons who shop in our community. I urge this committee to amend H.R. 2348 and extend the International Falls 1% local sales tax, which was approved by our voters, to 30 years or $30 million. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, and we'll be in touch.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay, we have Matt Hilgart next, and Jason McCafflin, I understand, are the next two. Thank you, Mr. Hilgart. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Matt Hilgart. I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties. AMC represents all of Minnesota's 87 counties. We want to thank the Chair for her inclusion of two AMC priorities, in particular, House File 1163 by Representative Marquardt and others on this committee, which is the Joint Local Government and County Program Aid Bill, as well as a Representative Murphy bill, which continues the prior state commitments to the para-pension aid. In particular, I know this committee remembers the testimony that County Commissioner from Lac-La-Parle gave, where he said back in 2000, a CPA was 32% of their levy, and today it's less than 7. And that the fact that 2018 CPA kept their levy from being 7.9% and kept it at 2%. So this is a very important funding source, and these stories are true across the state. So we appreciate this committee's support, as well as the governor's support for this very important program. On the pension aid piece, I would just mention that this goes to folks outside of just cities and counties. This goes to townships, joint powers, hospitals, libraries, SWCDs, watershed districts, and more. So this isn't just impacting your local communities in terms of city and county tax relief, but also other taxing jurisdiction relief. We also support the County Veteran Service County Assessor data sharing provisions, the work of Minnesota Department of Revenue and Representative Hertaus and others who are working towards some language and consensus around the fractional homestead language, and the fire remediation grants for Mazeppa and Wabasha counties. The last thing I would just mention is on the state assessed report language. We support the report language, but just want to underscore the magnitude of the cases that we're hearing about in tax court and at the Supreme Court levels right now. We heard testimony from Clearwater County, which said that in their worst-case scenario, and this is regarding the Enbridge versus State of Minnesota tax court case, they would be looking at a potential liability of $9.2 million payback, a refund payback, while their total levy is less than $8 million. So we just want to underscore that magnitude and do support House File 424, Representative Sundeep's efforts on this issue. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hilgart. And just part of why the study is addressing the state-assessed properties, we did have an extensive hearing on this, but we haven't had a chance publicly to say since we've briefed the members, but the Supreme Court did rule and did rule in favor of the Department of Revenue, and so now the tax court is going to have to reassess those values. So we're still learning. It's still being processed in the courts, and this study will give us more information going forward. Thank you. And we're going a bit out of order to just take some people who've traveled a farther way. Please introduce yourself to the committee, and after you, we'll hear from the city of Worthington.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jason McCaslin. I'm the Jackson County Assessor. I'm also here representing MAAO. I submitted a document that was developed in collaboration with between the DOR and MAAO about the fractional homestead issue. Basically, to start things off, I'd like to thank Senator Hertaus for the work he's done carrying the bill this far. It's been absolutely fabulous. During the point in time that we sat down with the DOR and began reviewing some of the issues that we might encounter as we move forward, we did highlight some items where the language in the bill might cause some unintended consequences, something that even when I reviewed the bill for the first time, I didn't consider, but thanks to the DOR staff, they were able to point some of this stuff out. In the document, it does highlight some of the exceptions that should probably be considered for inclusion in the bill as amendments. One of the things I'll just kind of point out quick is that you take spouses considered as one owner, for example. If you take the way the bill's written literally, if my wife owned the house and she didn't live there but I did, I wouldn't be able to homestead it, stuff like that. So it's important that some of these exclusions are reviewed for possible inclusion into that bill just to ensure that we get this done in one shot and we're not moving forward in future years trying to fix stuff. I think I can end with that. I was told to be as quick as possible.
Thank you very much, and we always appreciate the professional advice from people out in the field who are dealing with these things. I appreciate that. And next we will have Steve Robinson and Chad Cummings from Worthington.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I'm Steve Robinson, the City Administrator in Worthington. First, I want to thank you for including us in Request that you reconsider the modifications that you made. The reductions were 60% of the original request, which will have a significant change in scope or number of projects. Part of my problem is to worry about consequences. Has there been any thought or discussion about potential legal consequences a city may face by a change in the project and the legitimacy of the referendum that was undertaken in November? And would there, and somewhere in this bill, would the city have provisions for immunity that we would not be subject to a citizen or voter lawsuit? And with that, I want to turn the next thing over to City Councilman Chad Cummings. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much, and greetings from the turkey capital of the world, Worthington, Minnesota. We are a regional hub. We serve a spot on the map that is 11 miles from Iowa, 40 from South Dakota. We have Highway 59, Highway 60, and I-90 all coming in. We host the National Windsurfing Regatta on our beautiful Lake Okabena, which was part of our project entailed in there. We have regional soccer tournaments that bring teams from five different states and hundreds of people to our soccer stadium, soccer fields and complex. We also, for years, were known as hosting the National Junior College Wrestling Tournament in Worthington, Minnesota, and as a Hall of Fame coach's son in Minnesota. We now host the Blue Jay Open, which brings in 270 wrestlers from over 25 schools. We bring people to an area where there is no peer community of our size within 60 miles. So the regional concepts of what we are looking to bring in, including things like the Great Labor Day Classic Golf Tournament, they are great regional sources, and the projects entailed with overwhelming report, almost 68 return on the positive vote for our projects, are something we would ask you to reconsider. Worthington is a regional hub. We thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for taking the time to come here and share your thoughts. Next, we have Keith Carlson from the Minnesota Inter-County Association.
Madam Chair, members, I am Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Inter-County Association that consists of four suburban counties and 10 greater Minnesota regional center counties. I also want to indicate our appreciation of the Chair's inclusion of funding for CPA as well as LGA, and particularly the inclusion of PERA aid. The latter was a commitment that was made by the legislature in 1997 to help amortize the deficiency in the PERA general plan. A substantial deficiency still exists, so we would appreciate its continuation. Also want to acknowledge the ag school bond credit increase in there has been significantly helpful to farmers, as well as the increase in the PTR or homestead credit refunds. These have been appreciated for helping homeowners throughout our state. The fractional homestead allocation has been championed by Representative Hertas. We appreciate its inclusion, as well as the state assessed valuation. I particularly want to acknowledge the Chair's restraint in avoiding further complicating the property tax classification system. As members all know, the state has the most complicated property tax system in the nation, and appreciate for once that further complications were not added to the system by carving out narrow little niches for properties that some members believe need to further receive. I finally want to mention the exclusion of a provision from the public finance bill carried by Chair Marquardt that I think has been mistakenly characterized as a Hennepin County light rail transit provision. This provision would have allowed counties levying the local option transportation sales tax to issue revenue bonds serviced by that date. At least two of my member counties, which do not include Hennepin County, are interested in this authority to help them finance the cost of transportation improvement projects that they are financing through the local option sales tax, and would allow them to avoid burdening their local property taxpayers with the cost of servicing that debt. So would strongly recommend that that provision be added to the bill. That I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. And for members in the room, we have been able to secure the room further. Don't get nervous. We will hear from all who have volunteered to provide some insight. Patricia Nauman from Metro Cities. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. I appreciate the opportunity to comment today, and I will be brief. Metro Cities does support several provisions in House File 2348, Article 1, Section 1, that allows cities to fund historical societies through the property tax levy. Metro Cities does support that provision. Article 2, Section 1, Metro Cities does support extending the sunset on aid to local governments through PERA, as is provided for under the bill. Article 2, Sections 3 and 4, these are sections that deal with the homestead credit refund and renter's credit, and Metro Cities does support basically what I'll characterize as the expansions provided under the bill for those programs. Article 2, Section 13, Metro City supports the $30 million increase to local government aid as provided for under the bill. I will also note that we do certainly recognize the various local government aid bills that have been introduced this year that would make some modifications to the formula, and we look forward to additional discussions with you and the committee, Madam Chair, on the LGA program and the formula structure. Article 3, Sections 3 and 4, these are provisions regarding the local option sales tax requirements provided under the bill. I know you're hearing from some individual communities. Metro City's policies do support greater access to other tax and revenue sources, including allowing local governments to impose a local option sales tax without the need for special legislation. The organization does not have a specific position on the provisions contained in the bill, but at this point, we are hearing from some individual cities, and I will perhaps have some additional feedback for you in the committee as this bill moves forward. Thank you again for the opportunity to comment, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you very much. Shane Zart, and after him, we will hear from Max Hall. Mr. Carlson has said he'd go. Oh, John Reynolds, I'm sorry. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Chair and members. My name is Shane Zart with Flaherty and Hood, and here today on behalf of the Coalition of Utility Cities. We thank the committee for its attention to the significant challenges that, that communities face when they have a great share of their local property tax base made up by state-assessed property, and our members are deeply invested in that conversation. Our members of the Coalition of Utility Cities are the eight cities in Minnesota that host the state's largest power plants, all of which are state-assessed personal property of the utility companies that own and operate them. And I think we've talked in this committee before about the scale of the impact, but one thing I don't think I've shared with this committee is a recent analysis that the city of Red Wing did, where the nuclear plant in that community is around half of the city's tax base. They did an analysis of some of their top property taxpayers. Number one, far and away, being the nuclear plant, but also on the list of their big box stores, the Target store in particular. But in terms of tax capacity contributed, it would take 153 of those Target stores to equal the tax capacity impact of the nuclear plant. So any shift in that tax base has a huge impact on the city and on local property taxpayers. And on that backdrop, you know, we thank the committee for the inclusion of the study on state-assessed property, on the recent trend and increase in administrative appeals and tax court challenges, the valuations of state-assessed property. And in particular, a specific explanation that is called for in the report calls for an explanation of the commissioner's methodology and decision-making in reaching a final valuation and settlement of administrative appeals. One situation that happened to a lot of our communities last year is that XL Energy, in particular, went through the administrative appeals process, was able to reach an agreement with the Department of Revenue, around a 7% reduction in their valuation, and many of those communities were notified of that change after they had already set their preliminary levies, which tied the hands of local governments to respond to that change. So I'll echo what a previous testifier said, which is that I know the committee has heard some options to address this issue or at least protect local governments in the event of tax court challenges. And that's an issue that we don't think needs further study. House File 424 that was heard earlier this session be a good tool to protect local governments and recognize that when these valuations are challenged, it's a fight that the local governments are not a part of. It's they are caught in the middle of and ultimately at the end of the day handed the bill for, but play no role in. So I thank the committee for its work on that. And I'll stand for any questions or I'll pass it on to the next testifier.
Thank you so much for your feedback. Next we have John Reynolds from the Multi-Housing Association, followed by Max Hall of AVSMECO. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. John Reynolds with the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. We are keeping an eye on the automated certificate of rent paid system in Article 2, Sections 5 and 6. Before getting into some of our concerns, I just want to thank Chair Loeffler for addressing a classification issue for the new data that is being collected in Subdivision 2 on page 53. The previous classification was a little unclear, and now that's clearly classified as return information. So we appreciate that. Our first concern is with how the system will play out in practice. We have owners that manage their property and keep track of rents, keep track of the unit information through sophisticated software systems, on Excel spreadsheets. Some do it on paper, believe it or not, and some even do it in their head, probably smaller owners. So having them interact with an electronic system may be more complicated than it seems at first glance. The second is just that there are many existing sources that provide the information sought in the study in Section 6 on page 54. For just a few examples, HUD provides housing market analysis for four or five different areas in the state that are quite detailed and offer rents by unit size. HUD also publishes fair market rents for many different areas that are used by local housing and redevelopment agencies who publish payment standards and utilities allowances. And lastly, the Star Tribune publishes for free annual rents by geographic area and unit size. And then our final concern is our members are a little wary about using the tax system to collect data that is not necessarily directly related to the tax filing system. So thank you again for the opportunity to testify. We look forward to continuing discussions with you, Madam Chair, and with the department as well.
Thank you very much. Mr. Hall. And next up after him will be Trent Dilks from the Disabled American Veterans.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, for the record, my name is Max Hall, and I represent AFSCME Council 5. We're a labor union that represents more than 43,000 workers in the state, ranging from state, counties, and cities. So we appreciate the opportunity to provide comments on the Delete Everything Amendment to 2348. Madam Chair, I'd like to just comment on three provisions that happen to be one of our top priorities. Of course, the two being inclusion of House File 1163, Representative Marquardt's bills to increase local government aid and county program aid. A majority of our members do work for local units of government, counties, and cities, and so these are obviously critical resources to provide for solid budgeting and to keep property taxes low. And so we appreciate inclusion of that. As well as obviously, county program aid and LGA specifically are important for like I said, budgeting purposes. But then also just making sure that our members typically work in the back offices, clerical staff, and so those typically in downturns especially are the positions that are often cut. But they're the positions that make cities and counties run. So those are very important. The last thing I'd like to mention is House File 2387, Representative Murphy's bill to extend the sunset on para aid. You've heard about that often, including this week, and I believe it was on Monday, as well as today, but we appreciate that being included in the Property Tax Division report. And like others, I'd be willing to stand for questions or just pass off to the next person.
Thank you so much, Mr.
Yep.
Hall. And now we'll welcome Trent Dilks, and then he'll be followed by Nan Madden. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Trent Dilks. I'm the Legislative Director for the Disabled American Veterans.
Today, first, I'd like to address the inclusion of the moving the deadline for the property tax value exclusion for our disabled veterans to December 15th, and the allowing of the sharing of data between the assessors and the county veterans service officers. I can speak for the Commander's Task Force, our 165,000 members, the United Veterans Legislative Council. When I say that, these are common sense solutions that ensure that our veterans get the benefits that they need, that they've earned, and that are in place for them, and we are fully supportive of their inclusion. The second thing I'd like to address is an opportunity for a potential amendment, and that is the exclusion of the language from House File 204 and 205. I think it's fitting that I'm sitting here on Welcome Home Vietnam Veterans Day, and I did send an email out to the committee members and leaders of the veterans organizations in Minnesota when we saw that 204-205's language was not included in the initial report. And the story that I briefly will share with you is Lori Pekarik. She is the surviving spouse of a Vietnam veteran. She left work early. They blew through their retirement savings as her husband attempted to secure his benefits as a result of his illnesses from Agent Orange. And then for the next 20 years, she served as an uncompensated caregiver. She left behind retirement and work time. When her spouse passed away, she saw a 64% reduction in her benefits, which is what happens when the veterans' benefits move to surviving spouses' benefits. At the same time, the current 8-year limit started to tick, and she had a property tax bill that was going to come due down the line. For the last 5 years, we have been working to make this to the lifetime of the surviving spouse, or if they remarry. Lori is now in her 8th year. She testified in the Military and Veterans Affairs Committee in the House here, and through tears, she was told the committee that she called her assessor, found out what her potential property tax bill, and if we do not eliminate the 8-year limit this year, she will not be able to stay in her family home of 46 years. And it's something we'd like to get done. During Veterans Day on the Hill, when we had 700 veterans over in the Rotunda, I told the story of Christine Stone, a 96-year-old surviving spouse of a World War II veteran from the Battle of the Bulge. She is in the 8th year of her exemption, and she would like to remain in her home for her last years here, and she will not be able to afford if we get this to stay in her home if we don't get this done. Overall, and in that email it did cover, we're not talking about a lot of money. We're talking about 1/100 of 1% property tax shift in the given counties. That's according to House Research. The numbers do come from 2017. Overall, the state would see, according to House Research, see a savings because they wouldn't pay out a credit to people who receive that, the additional ones who receive that. Again, House Research in 2017, at that point it was House File 119 when we couldn't get it included. This is the number one priority of the Commander's Task Force, of the United Veterans Legislative Council, of all of the veterans organizations in Minnesota. We do not do enough for the surviving spouses who give so much, who have no compensation, who see their benefits cut, who leave work early, who save the taxpayers millions of dollars by keeping our severely disabled veterans out of taxpayer-funded nursing homes and facilities. And this is a way that we can show them how much we care about what they do and how much we appreciate what they've done for our veterans. I thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much for taking the time to come. And next we have Nan Madden. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project and appreciate the opportunity to testify today. I'd like to thank the chair and the committee for including an expansion of the renter's credit in this bill. I appreciate that you've taken the time this session to hear from renters and others about the economic challenges they face in this time when rents are growing more quickly than renters' incomes. The renter's credit successfully reduces the regressivity of Minnesota's property taxes, and it puts a limit on how big a share of a household's budget goes towards property taxes. In the testimony you've heard this session, you've heard how renters earning lower wages and seniors and people living with severe disabilities on fixed incomes spend their tax refunds in their local communities on some of the most basic expenses. They've talked about things such as toilet paper, toothpaste, and dental care or other health care expenses not covered by insurance. Because the tax refund often arrives in late summer, it also can make the difference in whether families can make essential purchases for children going back to school. The bill provides a larger renter's credit for currently eligible Minnesotans by reducing the copayment component in the formula. And we appreciate that as the bill also increases the income level at which renters can qualify for the credit, it retains the sliding scale structure of the renter's credit. Finally, as this bill moves forward and you put together the omnibus tax bill, I'd also encourage you to consider the inclusion of a provision from Governor Waltz's tax proposal that treats all homeowners equitably by allowing taxpayers with ITINs to qualify for homestead status. Thanks for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you so much. Next, we'll have Gary Wordish, and after that, Joan Lee. We've gotten some additional requests. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the representatives. Gary Wordish, president of the Minnesota Farmers Union. We're a grassroots farm organization representing farmers throughout the state, but strongly in support of Representative Marquardt's bill to increase the agricultural school bond credit to 70%. You know, it's been stated earlier, Commissioner Bowerly mentioned it in her testimony of a recent Minnesota Extension report showing that farm income is down lowest in the last 23 years. So we all know farmers are going through challenging times. But this would also help, increasing the school bond credit, it also help the rural school districts too. Because by reducing the burden on the farmers, it would also make it easier for them to upgrade their facilities throughout the state, because there's some of the rural school districts, the vast majority of the tax burden falls on the farmers and they don't have any choice. We don't have the industries in some of the areas to have a tax burden, so you know, you're looking at a small houses in some of the rural towns have very little value, so the tax burden does fall on the farmers. So this would be a help. If we're supposed to compete in a global economy, this has also helped the whole state too, because it shouldn't matter where your children are born. You know, throughout the state, all of our children deserve a high quality education, and this would definitely help get us there. So, thank you.
Thank you very much, and Ms. Jean Lee. Sorry to mispronounce your first name.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Reverend Dr. Jean Lee with Children's Hope International. We do legal advocacy. R&R Family Centers is our shelters, and I head APAC, which is a housing consortium. I want to thank you for being able to hear me this time, because the last time the bill was heard, I was in the hospital, so I could only send information. We ask that you support Representative Petersburg's amendment, which will be coming forward to solve some of the issues I'll briefly be covering here. We're one of the few organizations that actually do legal advocacy in this area. We've tried to refer our cases to legal services and legal aid, and they won't take these types of cases, and the taxpayers' assistance doesn't help these particular types of clients. What we're asking for are remedies that we have found in applicants trying to go through the senior tax deferral system or program, and such things that they have encountered would deny them from participating in the program, and oftentimes they don't know about it till within 30 days of them getting a foreclosure notice that there's a sheriff's sale, and scrambling to find people who could help them. And we have very little to go on, and the processes we try to do to solve them take much longer than the time that they have. So, for example, one of the things they require is showing ownership of title. We've had a case where the recorder lost the title that was supposed to be filed, and so the owner or the contract for deed holder that had the title transferred had passed away, so the new one couldn't be done, and that has to go through what they call a court action, quiet title, and then that takes a long process too. We've also had people not have title because the mortgage had their liens, but they've changed mortgage companies so many times because of their process of buying and selling these mortgage papers that they've been unable to get the proper information to get the title released. And so that's going to be another court action. We also have cases where there's fraud and scams where people are putting liens on the property who shouldn't be. Now, one of the things they do consider is, you know, what kind of liens you have as far as whether you qualify. So it's a court action to remove these liens. For some of them that are in the dire straits, they enter into what the department has called a confession of judgment under 279.37. But what we didn't know was there's another statute that affects changing titles or clearing up some of the titles when you have a confession of judgment. And that is section 272.12, where it states that you cannot file a transfer of title unless the taxes are paid up. Now, the senior program will pay on the confession of judgment, but if the person doesn't have title to begin with, they're kind of stuck. So Representative Petersburg's amendment will try and free that up so that a court order can kind of trump this 272.12 and overcome that barrier. We also have a concern as far as the timing of it, and that's as far as what happens, because some of the people are involved in locking into interest rate loans. Some of them need an expungement of the confession of judgment, and some of them are being affected by their credit bureaus by having the confession of judgment.
Ms. Lee, we have a lot of people yet and just a little bit of time, so you'll have to summarize. We'll look forward to the discussion that comes forth related to your amendment.
I'll summarize in that we really urge your support of Representative Petersburg's amendment because it will prevent these people from being homeless and all the costs that goes with that. So thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you very much. Next we'll have Tommy Johnson and Cam Winton after him. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Speaker, members. My name is Tommy Johnson. I'm the legislative officer for the Veterans of Foreign Wars, and I appreciate this time. I'm not going to take much time because Trent Dilks for the DAV spoke very well on this, that we want to see the provisions of House File 204 included. He spoke about the surviving spouse of a widow from the Battle of the Bulge. We also have widows, surviving spouses from the Battle of Chosin Reservoir in Korea, the Battle of Khe Sanh in Vietnam, and the future widows and survivor spouses from the Battle of Fallujah and more battles. We urge you, the VFW and the Commander's Task Force, of all of the major veterans organizations, urge you to please consider adding House File 204 into your report, and let's take care of our widows. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Cam Winton. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Cam Winton. I'm with the Dorsey & Whitney firm here on behalf of Northern Natural Gas. Folks may recall that Joanne Wright from Northern Natural Gas, its tax manager, came up here from Omaha on one of those freezing cold snowy days we had to share with you all Northern's journey through Minnesota's centrally assessed property tax system. And you may recall that Northern provides natural gas via its pipelines in 660 Minnesota counties and does business in 11 states across the U.S. Of those 11 states, since the year 2003, there's one state where Northern has challenged its property tax valuation. It's our state. Unfortunately, it's our state. Because, I say this with great respect for the civil servants in the Department of Revenue, because the Department of Revenue has taken an extremely aggressive approach to valuation of centrally assessed property since approximately 2012. And that's not Northern's opinion. That's the decision of the Minnesota Tax Court. So with that as background, I'm here to say three things on behalf of Northern. First of all, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for including in the division report the report provisions, the requirement that the Department of Revenue provide a thorough report to the legislature about centrally assessed taxation, appeals of valuations, and the steps that the department has taken. Just for your reference, that starts on page 46, line 9. So thank you for that report requirement. We certainly hope to see that in future versions of the bill as it wends its way through the process. The second point is that on behalf of Northern and other centrally assessed taxpayers, we continue to request that House File 424, the so-called State Pays Bill, be included. This is the one, you will recall, that lays financial responsibility at the feet of the state rather than at the feet of the counties. Just in case anybody hasn't tracked this, that provision is not in this bill right now. We certainly hope you'll continue to consider it and include it in future versions. Third and finally, Madam Chair, I recognize you're not taking extensive public testimony, but if I could just comment on one thing you said earlier. You are, of course, right that in the Enbridge case, the Minnesota Supreme Court remanded that matter back down and instructed the court, the tax court, to follow Rule 8100. I don't sit here on behalf of Enbridge, but that's just public record and publicly available fact. If I could add one further fact for your consideration and consideration of your committee members, it's that in the Northern Natural Gas case, both Northern and the Minnesota Department of Revenue agreed that the department has accurately implemented Rule 8100. And so the Minnesota Tax Court will be making its final decision in the Northern Natural Gas tax case in June of this year, we expect, late June of this year. And so I renew what I've said to many of you personally, and that is this issue is real. It is a freight train aimed at a cliff, and we appreciate, and I say that meaning that counties, local units of government, and essentially assessed taxpayers are all in a true pickle here, and we appreciate the committee's continued attention to this topic as we move forward.
Thank you very much. We have three more. Bradley Peterson.
And Madam Chair, as the next person's coming down, I just wanted to remind everybody on this day, 46 years ago, we've been hearing from veterans, the last troops left Vietnam on this day, 46 years ago.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Peterson, and next will be Gary Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Bradley Peterson with the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. I will be extremely brief. We are very pleased of the inclusion of the $30.5 million increase in local government aid in this division report. Seeing that number carried through the process for the next 2 months will be our organization's highest priority. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Mr. Gary Carlson, and then we'll have Amber Hansen Glazer after that. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. My name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. And Chair Loeffler, thank you for allowing the city officials to go first. Council member drove down here at 3 this morning from International Falls to attend this hearing, so I really appreciate you getting them on first. Briefly, we support Article 1, Section 51, the study that Mr. Cam Winton and others have testified on. We think that would be an important step in the process of trying to address this issue of challenges to state assessed property, so we do support that. Article 2, Section 1, the extension of PERA aid that was carried by Representative Mary Murphy, we really appreciate that. That was an important oversight in the omnibus pension bill last year. Article 2, Section 13, the appropriation increase that mirrors bills authored by Representative Vang, Marquardt, Liz Lagarde, Brand, and Hertas all had the appropriation increase at that level. We do strongly support that as well. And then, Madam Chair, I'll end on 2 points. Article 3, Sections 1 through 4, the changes in the local option sales tax process. I've been busy in the other body this week, and I haven't had a chance to talk to you more about that, but I know that you will continue to work with me on clarifying some of those provisions. And finally, Article 1, Section 1, that historical society expenditure provision. I hope that's not a jinx on an omnibus tax bill. That has been in 3 bills that have gone to the governor and have been vetoed, but we do support that provision, and we hope that can get get across the finish line this year. So thank you very much, Madam Chair.
We hope that you're not jinxing us here. We're going to work hard for that one. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Hansen-Glazer.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Amber Hansen-Glazer. I'm the Director of Public Policy for Minnesota Farm Bureau. And I just want to thank this committee and especially Chair Marquardt for the inclusion of the school building bond agricultural credit up to 70%. As you've heard from farmers over when this bill was heard in committee, it's a very important issue for farmers right now and making sure we're addressing the increased property tax burden on farmers and ranchers. So I just, on behalf of the nearly 30,000 Farm Bureau members, I just want to sincerely thank you for including this, and we look forward to getting this across the finish line this year. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on the bill before us? Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please introduce yourself.
I know the drill. Tony Quillis, representing Hospitality Minnesota and Minnesota Association of Visitors Convention Bureau. I will be very brief. Just two points of concern, Madam Chair. Article 3, Section 22 deals with the City of La Crescent local lodging tax. Under current law, it requires a Visitors and Convention Bureau to be created. And I know right now there are conversations ongoing with the Chamber of Commerce there, and I wanted to point that out for the creation of a Visitors and Convention Bureau, Madam Chair. And then very briefly, the major point of concern is Article 3, Section 26, dealing with the City of Plymouth and their local lodging tax. Currently under law, they can do three. There's another three on top of that, so a 6% lodging tax, which is one of the largest ones we've seen, Madam Chair, and then put on top of the 7.525 that is already existing sales and use tax in Plymouth would be 13.525 for our facilities to collect in Plymouth, and we're a little concerned that will make them uncompetitive with surrounding communities. Also, the lodging tax is to be used for capital improvements at public recreational facilities. We think that might be a little bit more appropriate for Representative Murphy's Capital Investment Committee to be used for lodging tax, Madam Chair. And then just two other points. Thank you for the five-year expiration date that's in there. And then there is a creation of a Visitors and Convention Bureau, but under existing law right now, 95% of lodging taxes are supposed to go for the creation of a Visitors Convention Bureau and marketing and promotion, and this only uses one-third of it, and two-thirds goes to that capital improvement for recreational facilities. Madam Chair, thank you very much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And is there anyone else? Thank you all for listening respectfully, taking the time to come down here and share your thoughts and feedback. We will take this under serious consideration. On Monday, we will have opportunities for the committee to discuss the bill as well as offer amendments. And for the ease of our staff, for members, you can offer a bill as an amendment. You don't need to have it reframed as an amendment, and if you have any questions about that, our House research staff will be glad to tell you more. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and just a couple of questions or comments, both, I guess. As we move to Monday, and we're going to be working on the bill and perhaps offering amendments, which I would expect, what is your plan with regard to the schedule after that and before spring break? Are we going to be meeting on April 8th, the following Monday, or are we going to be concluding property tax committee meetings next Monday?
Thank you, Representative Hertas, for that. The intention is that we would conclude our amendments to the Property Tax Division report and then forward that on to the full tax committee, which will then have jurisdiction over that. We may have some interim hearings or other things, but it is not anticipated that we will have further meetings within this session. Do we need to have a formal meeting to adopt the revised thing report? No, thank you. I'm just confirming.
Well, thank you for that, and I think there's probably a number of bills that just didn't get heard, and there might be an opportunity along the process that they might be heard, and they might make their way, maybe, if heard or whatever, as amendments to Chair Marquardt's committee as they come further along. As we've heard
Representative Hirsch, I also should say that our staff really needs to get the amendment proposals before the end of the day so that we have time to process them and they're ready for the committee on Monday. So just heads up. Thank you.
Thank you for that. I'll conclude for now.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, members and members of the public and all who have contributed to this division report. We appreciate your feedback and information and always welcome that. With that, the division is adjourned.